The Restaurants Association of Ireland has launched its pre-budget submission. We'll be hearing the budget in a little over under a month. Joined on the line now to discuss this by Chief Executive of the RAI, Adrian Cummins. Adrian, you're welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon.
I suppose your submission is designed to make the trading environment for all of your members that little bit more hospitable. What's the keynote ask from you?
Well, the keynote ask for us, you know, from a budgetary perspective, is the continuation of the employment wage subsidy scheme into 2022. It's important that our industry is supported after having been economically flattened for nearly 18 months. And we only opened our doors, not fully, because we still are under restrictions until the 22nd of October, but we've opened since mid-August this year. And we're now trying to trade back out of what we would see across our industry is massive debt within our industry, massive problems around shortage of skilled labour. And for an industry now that has huge potential to employ a lot of people in the future, we need to make sure that this industry is supported. While we recognise the support that we have received at the moment, we're looking for a continuation of the support so that there is no cliff edge at the end of this year. And it's also very important around the VAT, the 9% VAT rate, that is extended right into 2023 and beyond, so that we have a competitive and viable industry for the foreseeable future.
I noticed that one of the other requests that you've made, Adrian, the stay and spend scheme, I mean, it was announced just before we all went back into lockdown or near enough, as made no difference last October. Very, very, very few people took up anything or spent any money on it. It seemed quite convoluted, quite clunky to use. We've seen in Northern Ireland today the launch of a £100 retail voucher, which can be used for hospitality. Is that something that you would like to see here?
Well, I think there is cross-party political support around a voucher scheme. We saw that at the Oireachtas Committee for Tourism. We're all for the Tourism Committee, which has cross-representation, recommended that a voucher would be put in place. And we would like to see that happen in the first half of next year, where, you know, in January and February, there are quite lean months of the year for hospitality, and that is where we see an opportunity for the government to continue the reopening, continue the incentive for people to go out and spend in hospitality. And if they wanted to widen it out to retail as well, that's the matter for government. But we would be looking for a more amended scheme. The stay and spend scheme didn't work. It was too clunky. People didn't understand it. And it just didn't operate properly. So a voucher scheme like in Northern Ireland would help our industry greatly, especially in the early spring of next year.
Now, should such a voucher come to pass, you need people to be working in the establishments in order to enable patrons to redeem those vouchers. There is a shortage in several sectors of skilled and unskilled labour. Hospitality is certainly not alone in that. But what are you proposing to try and redress that?
Well, we're proposing that from a skills basis, there's a two-pronged approach to this. First is on the training side within Ireland. And our apprenticeship programme is just not working for us. We're treated in a discriminatory manner, because the old apprenticeship schemes get supported 100% when apprentices are in college, where the employer doesn't have to pay for while they're in college. But all the new apprenticeships, which are chefs, is one of those, chefing, the employer has to pay for the student while they are in college, which is very costly for all businesses. Well, not just in chefing, it's right across all these new apprenticeships. So we need to level the playing field, everybody treated equally, and that's one factor. Then on the other side is on the intermediate basis, trying to bring in staff from outside the European Union. 98% of our restaurant industry find it difficult to find staff at the moment. So we need to beef up our work permits program. That means putting in resources to make sure they're fast-tracked, and also visas as well from non-EU nationals coming into Ireland. So you can see it on your bulletins already that there's issues around lorry drivers, there's issues around construction, issues around retail. Right across the economy, we have huge problems now in skill, having finding staff. And we feel on a temporary basis, we need to look at going outside the European Union because they have the same issues as well.
Do you think, though, Adrian, that that will have any particular efficacy given that many people that are currently living and working in Ireland are finding housing incredibly difficult to come by?
Yes, and I get that issue as well. But, you know, we have an opportunity now to bring in staff into certain parts of the country where you may have a supply of accommodation. That might be on the West Coast where even businesses down there are finding it difficult to find staff.
Mm.
So I think this is about a supply and demand. We have a huge demand, a very little supply of staff, of skilled labour in our industry. We have a huge demand and very little supply of housing, specifically in parts of the country, in a higher perspective around the larger urban areas like Kildare and Dublin. But in the West Coast, you would have extra supply of stock, especially coming in the winter time until we get into the summer season next year. So I think on a temporary basis now, we need to look at bringing in staff from outside the European Union into Ireland. And maybe there has to be some sort of an incentive here for employers to make sure that they provide accommodation for these people coming in on an initial basis so that they have a secure accommodation when they do come in. But, you know, we are sitting down with government, but we need to speed this process up because it is at a critical nature now for our industry where some businesses just can't open 7 days a week or even 5 days a week.
Adrian Cummins, Chief Executive of the Restaurants Association of Ireland, thank you indeed for joining us. Now, €150,000 is being allocated to political parties to drive greater female participation at the advent of the next local elections, which are in 2024. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Catriona Gleeson, Chief Executive of Women for Election. Catriona, you're welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Ciara. Thanks for having me on.
Delighted to do so. I suppose in the face of it, this seems a positive news story, but it's not that much money.
Well, it's not that much money, and it is, I suppose, it's a positive news story in the context that there is an initiative. And I suppose just to frame it, really, we're, as I've been on before discussing, we're sitting with Ireland in the bottom half of the world in terms of our performance around gender equality in politics. We have 31 more women in the Dáil now than we had 100 years ago. So we've a very low representation with just one in five women approximately, or one in five TDs being women, both in the Dáil and then in local politics, the numbers are the same at 25%. So we've a lot of work to do to achieve a democracy that's actually reflective of the society we're in, that's reflective of the diversity of men and women in Irish society. And I suppose we're coming out of or maybe we're not, but we're certainly looking back at 18 months of a pandemic when at the decision-making tables about issues that affected every single person's lives, there was often no women present, and occasionally there was a singular or maybe two women present. So the impact of not having women at the decision-making table has a serious effect on all of our lives. So I suppose setting that in context, so in any initiative that's going to help increase more women in politics is very welcome. This particular initiative is actually a reform of an existing fund that the government would have been paying to political parties based on the number of women that they had elected within the party. So we welcome that this initiative now is more targeted.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a slight increase in the money that's going to the parties. But I suppose the key thing here is that in order for us to get to that key number of 50-50 equality in politics, what we're looking at is creating the space within politics, and that is on the ballot sheet that the political parties are putting forward sufficient numbers of women to give the electorate the choice to actually vote for women. So at the end of the day, Women for Election are nobody else. Political parties have no control over who gets elected to government.
Mm.
But we do have, and political parties particularly have the opportunity to choose that they're running women on tickets, on ballot sheets, in winnable seats, and they're running women in sufficient numbers. And so they have both the power and the choice to make this difference. And so we're hoping that these kind of initiatives will give them the opportunity to do more internal training, more internal policy change, and more internal planning, so they actually make that difference.
Now, each of the parties clearly will have their own plans for how they will use their respective allocations, but I'll just clap very quickly through what each party has gotten. So Fine Gael got the largest allocation, 36,000. 30 grand is going to Fianna Fáil. The Greens get 28. Sinn Féin's allocation will see them receive around 15 grand. Labour will get 24,000. The Solidarity grouping will get 8. No money being allocated to the Social Democrats, while the Independent group will be allocated 5,400. As we've said, these are not particularly significant sums of money, although Katrina, if somebody handed you or I any of those amounts, we'd be delighted. But in terms of creating practical, visible change in female representation in politics, how much use is this funding going to be?
Well, I suppose we're going to probably need to see a year or two of this fund to actually see if it's making any difference. And we'll be kind of quickly starting to see that in our engagement with the political parties. And what I suppose we'll be doing is working with them to see where there's opportunities for us to be very cohesive in our approach, so that the training programs we're delivering are available, and vice versa, that basically women who are coming out of our training programs have pathways into the political parties. So I think in terms of, I don't have insight into or knowledge of what each party has been allocated for, only that I know the scheme has become more targeted than previously. So previously the parties, as I said, were given it almost on not quite a per head basis, but similar to that. So it wasn't as directive. But I think it will take time, Ciara, to see. It is a small amount of money, but at least there's something being given to actually incentivise parties to do more. And as we're coming into the beyond 2023, the other big incentive there is the gender quotas. So there is there will be a requirement for 40% of the candidates on the ballot paper to be women, at least 40%. And so this funding will hopefully help parties to encourage more women to be available, but also to actually make sure that they're equipped and supported when they run. But I think it's the tip of the iceberg in terms of the resources needed.
It would be really interesting, Katrina, to see how the parties choose to expend this money, not only on the type of training, upskilling or practical supports that they may make available to women that they feel could conceivably go on a ballot paper for their party, but also the geographical way in which they elect to spend it. Because some areas of the country, Kildare County Council, for example, has a reasonably strong number of female councillors. Others aren't in that position. So they'll have to target it in several ways, geographical among them.
Yeah, and I'm hoping that there will be. And I know in Women for Election, we're looking at a very targeted approach in terms of the geography of the country, but also in terms of the diversity of women coming forward. And I think that's a really important important awareness to be bringing to this as well, is that, you know, we don't want to arrive at 50-50 with just one cohort of women in Irish society being represented in any forum. And so, you know, some of the parties are doing much more work in terms of intersectional, increasing diversity in terms of ethnic minorities and other more marginalised populations within Irish society. So I think I would hope that we'll start to see more of that coming through with the parties and what they're doing, and that we'll work quite closely with them. We're a non-partisan organisation, so we work across all of the political spectrum and none, you know, in terms of independence. So I think we do need to have a very targeted approach. You know, Kildare is a really good example of where there's a significant increase in women in politics, but that didn't just happen overnight, and that needs to be sustained as well. But the leadership that's been offered within the local government and within the various parties in Kildare have made a big difference to who's been put forward.
Well, Katrina Gleeson, Chief Executive of Women for Election, thank you for your time this afternoon. Waiting lists for all forms of hospital treatment are careening towards the million person mark, while we have hundreds of consultant posts vacant right across the health service. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Sinn Féin's health spokesperson, David Cullinan. David, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon.
It's kind of like a perfect storm, really, when you put those two statistics together.
It is, I suppose. We know that COVID obviously has complicated matters, and obviously over the last 16 months, there has been a concentration on keeping people safe in hospitals, on preventing people for non-essential reasons, including people who need treatment and who need to see a consultant coming into hospitals. We saw most non-urgent care cancels. So obviously all of that has an impact on the overall figures and where we are now with healthcare. But if you look at the big numbers, which the mind boggles when you actually look at them, 900,000 people on some form of health waiting list, either for a procedure or to see a consultant, and of that then 70,000 of them are children, are really high figures. And what's really concerning is how long those people are waiting. So about 190,000 of those people are waiting longer than 18 months, either to see a consultant or for a procedure, in some cases both. So obviously these wait figures are very, very high.
Mm.
And then you look at the other end of it, where we have consultant posts which are not being filled. There's 3,600 consultant posts which have been approved by the HSE, and 331 of those posts still remain vacant. And the problem is that figure has been static now for a number of years. And then of the remaining ones, there's about 370 of those which are filled either by, on a temporary basis or by agency staff. So we're obviously not even filling the posts that we have approved. And that's even before we talk about all of the additional posts which would be necessary to get us to a point where we can actually start reducing the wait times and the waiting lists. And we saw last week a report from a number of hospital consultants and specialists saying that it could take up to 14 years before we can even start to make a serious impact on wait times if there's no change in the capacity that we have in hospitals across the state. So it's obviously, it's a very, very serious situation.
Mm.
Yes, made worse by COVID, but it was a problem long before COVID came.
And the fact that it's such a long-standing problem, David, really points to the fact that for a variety of multifaceted reasons, individual consultants are electing not to work in Ireland.
I think that's part of the problem. And one of the issues, and I meet with the Irish Medical Organisation on a regular basis and also the Irish Hospital Consultants Association. And obviously, we all want to see as many consultants come into the system as possible, come and work in the Irish healthcare system. And they offer up two reasons as to why it can be very difficult to attract consultants. One is the fact that there are huge pressures because of the fact that it's got to a point where wait times are so high that they have to battle all of the time to get access to diagnostic equipment, to surgical theatre capacity, which can be quite limited in some hospitals, means that while they can see patients, they can very often then have to wait an awful long time before those patients can actually get the treatment that they need. And we know in some hospitals, surgical theatre capacity is very precious. The time slots available to consultants is quite precious, which means that there isn't enough capacity. But there's also an issue that arose in 2012, and this happened across the public service, where on the back of the huge cuts that were made at that time in public spending, and if you remember when all pay in at that time, new entrants into the public system, was cut by about 10% across all of the boards, across the board and all increment grades. In the vast majority of cases, those cuts were reversed. But for hospital consultants, it has not been reversed. So we have a two-tier pay structure. And I suppose if you're trying to recruit very senior specialists and people who are sought after in other parts of the world, and you're saying to them that we don't value the work that you do, that we're not prepared to reverse those cuts that were put in place, then it's not difficult to imagine why it can be difficult then to recruit some of those to come into the system. So certainly recruitment and the inability to recruit is part of the problem. But I think there's an even deeper problem with the capacity in hospitals and the fact that, you know, we don't have enough beds, we don't have enough support staff to make sure that hospitals are operating at safe staffing levels. But equally, we don't have the diagnostic capacity or the surgical theatre capacity. And we have over 200,000 people in this state who are waiting over 12 months for a diagnosis, for access to some form of scan. So these are really, really big numbers in European comparison terms, and it shows, one, the scale of the problem, but also the scale of the challenge that faces any minister for health or any government in terms of trying to deal with it, what is a very real problem.
Because trying to resolve all of those issues, because as you've noted, David, there are several facets as to why consultants may be choosing not to work in Ireland, or why consultants perhaps who have qualified and practiced here for a time may elect to go elsewhere. But around half of the problem is really representative of the entire problem with the entirety of the health service. It's infrastructural, it's resource based, it's capacity based. Arguably, it could be working culture based. And then you have the other aspect of that two-tier pay system. Why particularly hasn't that been addressed, David, if it's an identified problem?
I don't know. It's a short answer, because I know in Sinn Féin's alternative budget every year, we provided for dealing with that two-tier pay issue. And I think it's probably wrapped up in the new contracts which are being offered, which I support, which is what are called Shalanta Care contracts or public-only contracts. So the problem is that we have a number of complicated contractual systems in place for consultants. We have what are called Type A, Type B and Type C contracts. And then we have these new Shalanta Care contracts. And there may be some resistance from some consultants to moving to a public-only contract. And I would imagine that in part is why we haven't seen movement on some of the other issues. And I've said to the Minister for Health directly, and in fact I met Paul Reid, Director General of the HSE, a number of weeks ago, but I also met Robert Watt, who is the Secretary General in the Department of Health, that they need to be engaging with the groups that represent consultants, which is the IMO and the Irish Hospital Consultants Association. I support public-only contracts, but we have to ensure that if there are any flexibilities in relation to the contracts which are on the table, but also dealing with the two-tier pay issues, that we, as best we can, reach an accommodation so that we can then resolve these issues and then go out there and compete for consultants across the board. And I think that's what they want. And I'll be addressing the Irish Hospital Consultants Association conference in a number of weeks' time with Minister Donnelly. And I addressed last year's one as well. And I have to say that while pay was one of the issues that came up, the biggest concern was the lack of capacity and the fact that in many cases they actually don't have the tools and the infrastructure in the public hospitals that they need to do the work that they need. And it was exposed again with the cyber attack, where we know a lot of the diagnostic equipment which does exist is antiquated. They break down on a regular basis. They're not fit for purpose. So we need to see a complete overhaul and modernisation of that on the one hand, as well as the increased capacity in bed, surgical theatre capacity, as I said, and elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And yes, it's a big challenge. But I can just give one example. In last year's
briefly, budget, if you would, David.
In last year's budget, the government made great play of the fact that they were going to hire 15,000 staff, but also make $1.2 billion available for new measures. About $400 million of that will not be spent this year. And in simple terms for your listeners, that means 160 beds that should have been opened won't be opened. About 7,500 staff that should have been hired won't be hired. And that's what I think frustrates people, that when commitments are given, it's not followed through, the capacity isn't put in, and then the situation gets worse. And we've got to a point now, as you said, that we're going to very quickly reach the 1 million mark. And we need a plan very quickly put in place that prevents that and allows us to start easing into waiting lists.
Sinn Féin's health spokesperson David Cullinan, thank you indeed for your time. Well, now, the Society of the Irish Motor Industry has expressed deep concern about proposals by the Tax Strategy Group, which it says are retrograde and regressive, which would effectively propose an increase in vehicle registration tax on electric vehicles. I'm joined now on the line to discuss this by SIMI Director General Brian Cook. Brian, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hiya, Ciara.
I'm no specialist in tax, but this does seem to be counterintuitive in proposal terms.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, we're at the start of a very exciting time in the electric vehicle project. The government have supports in place, and the industry now is supplying more and more electric vehicles to the car market. We'll be close to 8% of the new car market this year, having been just around 4% last year. So we are in the growth phase, but it's a very initial growth phase. And the proposals in the Tax Strategy Group paper last week would pull, to some degree, pull the rug from under those incentives. the average BRT increase under those proposals for an electric car is about €1,450, and some popular models, and we're talking about cars now that are €30,000-40,000, not really expensive cars. These are cars, our family cars, could go up by as much as €2,800. So, look, it's actually penalising consumers who want to make the right environmental choice and drive a zero-emitting vehicle. That's what it's doing.
It also means, Brian, that if you were just looking purely on the basis of price, if you didn't have a particular view about whether the vehicle was electric or not, and you were leaning towards the electric vehicle, you will choose petrol or diesel because of that extra €2,000.
Yes, I mean, it definitely can be a decision maker. We know customers, rightly so, are very, very price sensitive and very cost sensitive. You know, we've been through a lot as a country, and people are still very careful with their money. And the electric vehicles, they are the future. The government has set hugely ambitious targets to get 1 million vehicles out there in the next 10 years. And while the thing has only just started, to actually effectively increase the taxation on that and to charge customers for wanting to go and get an electric vehicle, it actually adds customer confusion as well. Like, are the government really going to be serious about this? Well, as we say, these are only proposals at the moment, and hopefully the government will see sense and our political leaders will show leadership, and they will not remove the current incentives or increase VRT in the budget in a couple of weeks' time.
Do we have any sense at all, Brian, as to the Tax Strategy Group's rationale for making this recommendation?
Well, it's very hard to see, because the day before there was another paper issued on electric vehicle strategy by the government, and it indicated that the reliefs would remain in place for at least another year. So I think we can only assume is that they're fearful of the cost of this. But again, I think that's only a very short-term view, because the benefits, the savings in fines, the savings in emissions, and the saving in quality of life, you know, in our towns and cities throughout the country, will more than offset any increased cost, because we are going to sell more electric vehicles next year. But the extent of that success will be determined partly by the level of support that the government gives to them.
And also, should measures like this come to pass, it will also mean that we will have, in emissions terms, a two-tier domestic car market, because you will have people who have that extra bit more cash to splash will be more likely to go for electric vehicles, and then will be on course to meet government 2030 targets. And those with less won't.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, Ciara. And I think that's why we need to sell as many possible new electric vehicles as we can over the next 3 or 4 years, because that will create a used car market sooner rather than later. And for people who don't have the spending power to buy a new car, a used car is, for many people, is their real option. So the more new electric vehicles we can sell this year, next year, and the year after, the better chance we have of having an active used car electric vehicle market in 2025, 2026. And that will bring more and more people into the electric vehicle space. So I think that is a hugely important issue.
Well, Brian Cook, Director General of the Society of the Irish Motor Industry, thank you indeed for joining us. Now, Alone has released its annual report for 2020, showing it assisted a remarkable number of older people. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by its Chief Executive, Sean Moynihan. Sean, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks very much.
15,000 older people supported in 2020, a staggering number. How were those supports accorded to those people?
I suppose our annual report for last year reflects the challenges that older people faced. And we've sort of 175% increase in the number of older people looking for support last year. And that sort of shows the challenges people faced in the pandemic. And ultimately is how we worked with government departments, our partners in the non-profit sector, and with everybody in the community, really creating the commitment that together we all try to respond to the older people who are most in need.
I know that you received 1,100 calls in a single day at its peak. That speaks to an awful lot of people really probably in some state of distress, and certainly needing guidance as to what might have been happening on that particular day and what was available to them.
Yeah, I mean, for us, you know, the big sort of story of older, for older people, Wires, the level of anxiety last year, the level of loneliness, the level of concern, the level of mental health, people whose mental health was challenged. And so ultimately it is where we would have been providing an integrated service, still looking at housing issues, transport, health issues, all those other things. This was the big increase. The amount of people who maybe had been independent before this, but then found that they needed help, or those who already needed some help, but ultimately is were really now struggling because of everything that was happening in the pandemic, or services that had disappeared, or supports that they needed.
And I would imagine, Sean, that there were a fair proportion of those people reaching out to you that were doing so for the first time, because they may have been very socially connected up to the beginning of the pandemic and then found themselves completely isolated.
Yeah, I think that has been the challenge. I mean, we forget things so quickly, but you know, we remember all the older people we lost last year, what happened in nursing homes. We also remember that for so long, people were confined to travelling in very small areas. So some of the support people got from families traditionally may not have been available, or due to illness and risk, sometimes people had to cancel home help and home care because of the worry of that the home helper, the home carer might bring COVID through the front door. So, and then an awful lot of people who will have been bereaved last year, and then trying to support people around technology, support people around public health information that was constantly changing. And then at the same time, there's daily challenges around health, welfare, fair finances. All these still had to be addressed because they didn't go away just because of COVID.
One thing I was really taken by was I know that Alone was already a pioneer of use of assistive technology, but it really in a lot of ways came into its own for some older people last year. I'm talking about things like smartphones, tablets, pendant alarms and smart home sensors.
Yeah, I think for us, we've like what we call a living lab. We use our network of staff and over 3,000 volunteers across the country to try to install, distribute and respond to different points of technology. And I think we all think of technology. Sometimes we think of the Twitters and the Facebooks, and we think of maybe some of the negatives. But for older people in the now, but into the future, technology will be the key to empowering older people to manage their own health and well-being, safety and security, and also their social connectivity. You know, most of us drive a car but have no idea how it works. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So,
but you're just happy it does.
Not the fact that every older person has to become a programmer, but simple things like Alexa. So you can make phone calls, you can change the television stations, you know, on your Alexa. People can pop in and see you. You can get it to play music that you love. Lots of things that maybe for during health challenges or other challenges, maybe things like technology can make easier. Same with falls, safety, security. So we've been working on it many years, but we now see that has come of its time. Now, this is to drive human contact rather than to replace it, but ultimately it's tech for good to empower older people.
The 700% increase, Sean, to your telephone support and befriending services. And it would be remiss of me at this point not to mention the people who kept the show on the road. You had a massive increase, over a third, in the number of people who volunteered of their time to work with Alone. 2,000 volunteers at the start of last year, 3,000 by December 31st.
Yeah, I mean, that's really where the story of it. We went from 2,000 volunteers at the start of the pandemic, and we exit with well over 3,000 now. And so ultimately is I think that's a huge demonstration that the community does want to support older people, that the community is there to support the older people in the community and is committed to doing so, and that collectively we will respond to older people. And so we're on a journey over the next 3 to 4 years to 9,000 volunteers, because unfortunately that's the number of older people. The number of older people in the community is going up, which is a good thing, but it also means the number of people who need support is going up exponentially. So many of the people that came to us last year probably one in round 4 or 5, will need ongoing support. So now for us, the challenge going forward is to keep up at the scale that we're doing to make sure that we can provide services to all those people, to ensure that we now work to support them to age at home and improve the quality of life, and to make sure nobody's left lonely and nobody's left without the support they need to age happily and securely in their own home.
Sean Moynihan, Chief Executive of Alone, thank you indeed for joining.